This is the MLW Radio Network. From Midtown Manhattan and Orlando, this is MLW Radio. Now your hosts, Court Bauer and Mr. St. Laurent.
Welcome to MLW Radio. I'm Court Bauer, along with the Ginger Hayes himself, Mr. St. Laurent, out in Winter Park, Florida. And first and foremost, we want to thank Action Bronson for a little help on our new opening. That being said, coming up later in the show, Dave Meltzer, editor of the Wrestling Observer, will be joining us to talk all things Brock Lesnar and the wrestling business in general. But first, we have a little programming note here. Woo! Wednesdays start tomorrow here at MLW Radio. The first guest, one of today's hottest free agents, the man who is in great demand coast to coast and beyond, the man whose father was the Nature Boy's top rival. Tomorrow, Rick and Conrad catch up with the one and only Cody Rhodes. Flair coming to MLW Radio, my man, tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so excited. Everybody I've talked to is thrilled that Ric Flair is joining MLW Radio. The first show drops tomorrow. Yesterday I was out eating and a fan stopped me and said, are you MSL from MLW Radio? And I said, yes, sir, in fact, I am. And he goes, dude, how the fuck did you guys get Ric Flair? And I just smiled. It's so awesome. And Cody Rhodes is the first guest. It's going to be great. And you know, there's so many shows now. Everyone's so excited. We have had some people ask, hey, is it possible to subscribe to individual shows to keep my podcast feeds organized? And the answer is yes. We are going to be kind of transitioning in that direction. We're going to be available on Stitcher again. We're going to be available on TuneIn for Android and iOS, Apple CarPlay, and so many other platforms. When you go to MLWRadio.com, you'll be able to sign up for the Ric Flair Show feed. If you're a fan of this show and the VIP content, that'll be staying on the existing feed, but we will be over the next few weeks starting new feeds for the shows so you guys can pick whatever you want. I think it's going to be cool.
Yeah, and so everyone knows the premium stuff will stay on the main feed, MLW Radio's feed. And if you have the app, which is a great get, it's a free get. If you get it through the Google Play Store, you get it through Amazon, through iTunes, you get all the VIP content still through the MLW Radio app along with the flagship show. So that's the latest and greatest on that front. We also, while talking about plugging things, the VIP shows. Dave Bautista did a two-part series with Alex Greenfield last week, which was terrific, and he didn't hold anything back talking about his time at WWE, his 2014 run, and you got a real interesting perspective on what happened behind the scenes and why and how and all that stuff and how he feels about it to this day. A very revealing tell-all by Dave Bautista. I thought Greeny had a hell of a session with him, a two-parter. You don't want to miss out on that one. And also, History in the Making is returning as it's now a bi-weekly series, and Matt Farmer and I will be back this Thursday, looking at the Pacific Northwest / Portland territory, dating back to the early 1920s. It's a real fun show. Don't miss that as well. And that being said, some interesting stuff in the news these days. Today, actually, in the New York Post, there was a fascinating article, a bit of a Middle Eastern propaganda thing, as they're touting a 24-year-old weightlifter, Sajjad Gharibi. Have you seen this guy?
Yeah, I saw the pictures online. He literally looks like the Incredible Hulk, but not green. Never seen a human that looks like this.
No.
The article is saying he's training to battle ISIS. I don't know how powerlifting would effectively stop suicide bombers. I'm not sure.
Well, it's propaganda. But, man, I mean, they're trying. At its heart, it's anti-terror hype just to get people geared up, because ISIS does a very effective job of recruiting, unfortunately. But I look at this guy, and the slogan is he's going to smash terror in the Middle East with his biceps and triceps. My God, this dude really could. And I thought to myself instantly, the fact that he is so physically impressive, my God, he should be in wrestling. I mean, he would be a great heel in wrestling. He could be a great babyface in wrestling, depending on what path you wanted to go with him. But he's so freakishly huge. He's like custom made for pro wrestling.
Yeah.
I think back when every promoter in the early 80s looked to the Iron Sheik as a great box office appeal as the Iranian issues started to come to a head. And I look at this guy, and it's like it's very it's very much a hot topic today is what's going on in the Middle East. And this guy on either side of the fence, I think at least in the short term, could be a interesting special attraction. Yes, he's not trained, but he looks huge, and that's a big part of the wrestling business.
I think one of the things that's kind of limited heels in a way, because we've talked before about how wrestling by the media is kind of held to this double standard. So, you know, traditionally you could have, whether he's a babyface or a heel, but traditionally you would have this foreign heel monster. And if it was a movie, nobody would give it a second thought. And yet if WWE did bring in an Iranian heel, they would get shit from the media because it's wrestling. I'm not exactly sure why that is or if that's fair, but I do think there are some archetypes that historically have worked great that maybe are tricky to do now in this politically correct climate.
It's funny. You look at the 90s, and it was like the politically incorrect era, and everyone just pounded their chest saying it's great to be politically incorrect and F you to the man and everything. And now, because of so many different reasons and things in the world, and including advertising and the sensitive TV, it's a different time. And plus, wrestling doesn't have any leverage. It's really more now than ever, I think, major promoters are slave to these mitigating factors that create their inability to maybe get a little dangerous creatively in how they promote things, or maybe lowbrow in some of the ways they promote things. But that's the climate we live in, and it's harder to be pro wrestling, I think, in a politically correct environment. I'm not saying some of the stuff from yesteryear I want to see back, but some of it really made wrestling in a lot of ways so cool in a renegade subculture way.
Well, yeah, because in a movie, you could have murder or rape or theft or arson or any of these mm-hmm. things. I'm not saying that those things should be incorporated in wrestling, but in a movie, people would just say, well, he's a bad guy. Of course he would do bad things. And yet in wrestling, if a bad guy does bad things, the company gets blamed somehow. It's a very strange situation that wrestling finds itself in.
And that's where we find wrestling. But I look at this special attraction. He could be money in WWE if you look at what they've made over there. I mean, this is the kind of guy that you'd want to recruit, at least for a short term. Would he be able to pass a wellness policy test? I don't think so.
That's I mean, maybe he's not like chiseled. He's just like very large.
No, this guy looks unnatural. If you look at his frame, I mean, we'll put a picture up on MLWradio.com, but he's a supernatural beast. I'm thinking he had some sort of gamma ray exposure of some sort. I mean, it's just something very unnatural going on.
Can we post a link either on Twitter or on MLW Clubhouse so people can see this guy?
Yes, we will. And speaking of special attractions and maybe the supernatural, The Undertaker was briefly mentioned recently on a TampaBay.com article about a house that he sold a few years ago, becoming a party house on Airbnb. So you can actually rent the dead man's old house on Airbnb right now. What a wonderful time to be living.
Have you ever used Airbnb?
No, Greeny does a lot. You?
Like, no, I've never used it. What does Greeny use it for? Just when he needs a night out? Like, is he?
I don't know.
What kind of traveling adventures is Greeny up to?
Are you kidding?
I mean, I know you've got business trips all the time, but what is Greeny doing where he needs Airbnb?
Well, he is the resident Hunter S. Thompson of our podcasting network, so I think his adventures, wherever he goes, he requires a certain type of criteria for his lodging. But okay. I think when he goes out to L.A., he actually uses it a lot.
Oh, all right. That makes sense. Yeah, I saw this article. You know, neighbors are upset that it's a party house. I mean, I know here in Florida, because tourism is such a huge part of our economy and, you know, and the taxes and everything that are placed on hotels, you know, this is a big political issue down here. If they don't want people renting out their houses when the hotels are being charged, I think it's 13% tax down here. So they're trying to shut down a lot of this kind of stuff. And I don't blame them. I mean, in your neighborhood, would you want some random house being rented to different people every night as a party house?
If it's the Undertaker's party house, I got to say, I'm surprised there's not been a lot of fans have checked this out. But then again, the price tag for it per night is $999, which when you flip it upside down is 666.
That's true. And I mean, the Undertaker did burn down his house and kill his parents.
Was that – oh, my God. I forgot about all that. Yeah, that is true. Now, speaking of houses – WWE ran a series of house shows, including in Hawaii, out and in Japan over the last few days. I think a lot of the guys were a bit jet-lagged coming back to Monday Night Raw last night, just after about almost 24 hours where they had some downtime in between Japan and coming back to the States. Do you see any of the stuff online from Hawaii or Japan? It looked like everyone had a great time in Hawaii, and then as the grind goes all the way through Japan, you get a little exhausted, but to me, that would have been a fun special for the network. Maybe bash at the beach or something like that, but of course it's not cost-effective given what's going on over there right now.
No, I didn't see any of that stuff. I would be curious, though, if you know. What were they headlining the house shows with?
Well, one of the big matches was Kevin Owens versus Shinsuke Nakamura, okay, which was said to be fantastic, and I would love to have seen that match. I saw it firsthand in Ring of Honor, actually. I believe we did that in New York, and you know, it was a shorter match, as I recall, but those two had a great, great match and great chemistry between the two of them. Just they have something that mixes very well when you put them in the ring together, and I think you could do a great series with those two. On the flip side of this brand extension, which we'll talk a little bit about at length with Dave Meltzer in a few minutes. But what's your take on Shinsuke Nakamura coming up? And he's very charismatic. I think less is more with him on the mic. He does speak good English, but you know, still not something that he's totally comfortable with. How do you present him?
Well, I mean, I think the key with everybody, and they rarely do this, but to me the key is, What are you telling the audience is the guy's ceiling? And then let's see if the audience buys it or not. But give the talent the opportunity to convince the audience. So I want to see him brought in as a top guy, especially when they've got the brand split coming. Mm-hmm. I want to see him, like, from day one, treated as a top guy. His work is incredible. His physical charisma is off the charts. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And if he ends up in the mid-card in 6 months because it didn't work – well, that's better than starting him in the mid-card, because at least this way you found out what the ceiling was. So I would love to see a shift in philosophy just across the board with a lot of these guys. You know, he's headlined Tokyo Dome in front of, what, 60,000 people? They're going in this split.
A little less than 60,000. Okay, I think that's 50, the number they put out. But, yeah, I mean.
Yeah, 50,000. Until you tell the people he's not 35. A top guy, he is if you treat him like one, and then that's what I want to see.
He has so much charisma, and it's universal charisma. It's not just what he says on the mic, but yes, he does an effective job in his native tongue, but also in English. His entrance is over. My son loves Shinsuke Nakamura. My son's not really even a wrestling fan. He's probably the most casual fan there could be, but he loves Shinsuke Nakamura. He stopped when he saw me watching him, and he saw the entrance, and just the entrance alone just gave him the wow factor. And that's interesting. When you see that entrance, it really does make a lot of people get the goosebumps. And I remember seeing it live in Dallas and thinking, wow, this on a different stage. I mean, Ring of Honor doesn't have the production wherewithal that WWE has, and seeing it in Dallas – that was a special night to see it and see his debut against Sami Zayn, because when he came out, you could tell this was a star making a statement first time out debut. And man, what a debut it was for him out in Dallas. And, you know, one thing I want to bring up before we get to Dave Meltzer, we last week mentioned dissections. We talked a little bit about frogs, you eating squid, very peculiar
as a,
thing.
As a distraught element. Tree school student, yes.
I think Matt Farmer also sampled squid and dissected it out in the Pacific Northwest. But I said, you know, if there's any med school students out there that listen, which I doubted they did, to chime in on this. And it turns out we do have a med school student, or at least one, listening, as Patrick Burns tweeted us regarding the dissection topic. At med school, they actually dissect grown cats, among other things. And so there you have it. Dissection, very much a big part of anatomy and physiology and everything that goes into that whole end of the world. But just a gross topic, and I can't imagine dissecting grown cats, let alone squid. But I do love calamari.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have the stomach for it. I can barely handle dissecting raw. So more power to Patrick Burns.
And with that said, speaking of Monday Night Raw, I think it's time we checked in out in San Jose with the editor-in-chief of the Wrestling Observer / F4WOnline.com, Dave Meltzer. Dave, how's everything in San Jose today?
It's great. I mean, this is just, you know, have you like looked at the schedule for this summer? This is like
what about this craziest, week?
this week is just amazing. I don't even know what to say about this week with three UFCs in a row, but just this, if you look at, like, the whole summer, it's not going to end. I mean, because we're only we're, like, less than 2 weeks from G1 now.
Yeah.
And that's, like, a constant, you know, almost every day a big show. And there's the Super J Cup, like, with New Japan, and New Japan hasn't hosted the Super J Cup in, it seems like, forever. And, you know, WWE with the brand split and the SummerSlam, and UFC's got a big 202. I mean,
yes.
that's a real big show, you know. And then this one, which Saturday, it's, you know, that's the deepest UFC card I've ever seen. If you look at that, those matches from start to finish, it's like the opener is freaking Gomi and Jim Miller. And it's like, that's like a Fox, you know, a Fox Sports 1 main event right there. And that's the opener.
Yeah, and I look at even the Misha fight, and I wonder if this is good matchmaking in a way, because it's like, I want that title to always feel special and have its own place. And it's so buried down the card, three matches down, and I understand, hey, you never know, maybe there's an injury so it gets moved up, but you also have a UFC pay-per-view later this month, and I think that could have used some star power.
Yeah, that's going to – I don't think that pay-per-view will do that well, because
no.
People are already going to be talking about 202 by that point because of, you know, Connor and Diaz, and also, you know, Rumble Johnson and Glover Teixeira, which is a real strong match, especially after DC and Cormier, because DC and John Jones, because if Jones wins – then that fight becomes the number one contender fight.
Dave, do you think this show has crept up in any way? I mean, for people that closely follow UFC and are plugged in, it's a different story. But between the Brock fight being announced on short notice and WWE not really acknowledging it, I can't even tell you how many wrestling fans I've spoken to that are, like, peripherally aware that Brock is going to fight, but they have no idea it's this weekend.
Yeah, I can't speak to that because everyone I know is, but I did think it was interesting. You know, I was watching Raw last night to see, like, how many ads there would be during Raw for the thing. And on DirecTV, there was one. Because to me, that would be like Raw and SmackDown this week is where, you know, I would hit, like, heavy, heavy ad. I mean, where else would you hit better advertising, you know, in the sense of the Raw audience especially is going to be, you know, the audience is going to know Brock better than any other audience possible.
I thought they could have done a lot just to promote it. And, I mean, to me, your top guy beyond John Cena is Brock Lesnar. He's in part of one of the biggest sporting events of the year in the UFC 200 event, and it's not even acknowledged. It doesn't exist in this universe.
It's very interesting because obviously, you know, you watch the show and there were mentions of Brock on the show, all having to do with the announcement of SmackDown. And it's very clear the directive came from the top that
sure.
We are not going to promote this, which tells me whatever deal they worked out, obviously they're not getting a cut of the pay-per-view. So if they were getting a percentage of the pay-per-view, it would be in their favor to promote it. So so that tells me they're not getting that. But the other thing is, I don't know this, but just the way everything happened where they did talk about it at first and they went cold turkey, I wonder if they got swerved on the Mark Hunt thing. You know, the idea that, hey, we're putting him against a guy who's 12 and 10 and is 42 years old, and look at this, there's a picture of him, and you know, if you have Vince McMahon's eyes and you look at that, you just go, that's funny. And then somebody went, Vince, what the hell did you let happen? You know, I mean, but I don't know if that happened. But
Brock would know better,
down.
Right?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that one. Brock, I don't know what, you know, Brock's situation, I don't know what it is. I mean, obviously he's in it for the money. If Brock truly believes, as he says, that he wants to, you know, I mean, the one thing with Brock when he first started is, you know, he started out with Mir, who was a former champion, and his whole thing is, I don't want to waste time beating guys. You know, if I'm either going to be good at this or I'm not. And I think the whole deal is he's almost 39, and is he coming back to, you know, prove that to himself or whatever that he didn't do his best the last time because of the illness? I don't know the answer.
Do you think in Brock's mind, if he does very well, that he's going to – I mean, I don't know exactly when the WWE deal is up. I assume around WrestleMania. Is he looking to do this full-time again? I mean, like, what is the plan in his mind, do you think?
I think it all depends on what happens Saturday. I think after Saturday we're going to figure it out pretty good, because if he wins spectacularly – at that point, UFC would want him, and he would. I would think he would want to go, because then he would prove to himself that, you know what, he still has the chance to be what he wanted to be. If it's a you know, if he loses spectacularly, I'm sure it's the end, you know, him in UFC.
And, you know, looking at his WWE contract, which expires very soon, winning this fight and then just sitting out for 10 or so, not even 10 months, isn't the end of the world, really. He'd be sitting out, what, 7 months, 8 months?
Is this going to, was it two, I could check. I thought for some reason, I thought he announced a 3-year deal when he signed it. Because I remember thinking that, like, when he signed the contract, he was going to be done at 41. And I was thinking, like, okay, there's no way he's going back at 41 to UFC. So this was his last chance. And then here we are, you know, barely a year into the deal, and he's already going back. And I you know, the big thing that I don't know is like, exactly how Vince got talked into it, or, you know, what Vince's mentality was. Because clearly by not promoting it, he's got to have misgivings about it. And what Stephanie said also tells me there's misgivings. And if you have misgivings and you're risking your number two guy, it's just raises a lot of questions.
So what do you make of WWE just coming out and saying, you know, we're announcing Brock SummerSlam opponent tomorrow. So there's not going to be there. They could try to add heat later, but there's no heat explanation for why the match is taking place.
The only thing I can think of is the mentality that everyone's talking about Brock this week. Let's let them talk about WWE. But I think it's quite the risk, because what if Brock goes in there and gets hurt, which is a possibility? They've already announced this match. Then you're taking away a match that's on the card. I mean, again, it's not the end of the world, but it kind of makes you look like, you know, one of these promoters that announces a match before a fight, and then the guy gets hurt, and you know what I mean? You're kind of like, why would you even announce it before? You're taking it for granted. And it's like, you know, you can't take for granted anything about Lesnar and Hunt, because there are ways for Brock to win, and there are ways for Hunt to win, and there are ways for Brock to get hurt. And it's not, you know, the idea that Mark Hunt can't knock him out, I mean, that's, you cannot gamble with that. And if he is knocked out, I mean, they have their own concussion issue, you know, and their own problem. But then it becomes an interesting thing, because of the, you know, what happens if there's a commission suspension, and New York is a commission state. And granted, you know, there's so many weird aspects of this that nobody's really discussed. And that's why I think, you know, you can wait till next week to announce the match. You're not jumping the gun. And people will still, on Monday night, after Saturday, especially if Brock wins, people are going to be talking about Brock like crazy. And he'll still have every bit as much, you know, whatever it is, buzz on him Monday. And you'll already know on Monday, hey, Brock came out a hero. Why? If he does, let's just say Brock just goes out there, smothers Mark Hunt, beats him quick. Do you really then want to put him against Randy Orton? Nothing against
Randy
Orton.
Is that what they're going to announce in a few hours, is Randy Orton?
I don't know that for a fact, but that's what everyone seems to be saying. I mean, that's the impression I got. We'll find out. But whatever it is, you're locked into Randy Orton, when at that point, maybe Brock should be in the main event at SummerSlam against Seth Rollins or Dean Ambrose or whoever the champion is. And I mean, Dean Ambrose makes perfect sense. If Dean Ambrose retains, you've got your storyline. Brock destroyed Dean Ambrose in their feud, and Brock's the toughest guy in the world if he beats Mark Hunt. And it's like, that's a hell of a lot bigger main event than anything that they've got. Now, if Brock goes and loses, you know, then if Brock gets hurt, then there's another situation. So it's like, why do you paint yourself into a corner when there's, you know, 10 different things that can happen on Saturday night that would change Brock?
But if we're heading back to two world titles, does it even matter? Like, it seems to me like we're going to be heading back to the era of you can't really have a main event anymore.
I know what you're saying. You can't have a world championship when you got two world championships. You create two intercontinental titles. And then the intercontinental title and the U.S. title, you're creating two freaking TV hardcore titles. You know what I mean? As opposed to what you would really want. You know, you really, to me, want like that strong main title. And then the number two title should be, you know, like the old U.S., the old intercontinental, when, you know, it was like the guy who would be essentially either the number one contender or the number two babyface. And he's the you know what I mean? The guy who gets the title shot after the champion's already had his run. And that gives the other guy another run. I mean, you know, those belts should be, you know, far stronger than they are. You know, I mean, New Japan's the perfect example. I mean, you know, they have things they do right and wrong. But when they had Nakamura as Intercontinental Champion, nobody booked a better Intercontinental, belt for a couple of years than New Japan.
When I remember WWE, when we had separate pay-per-views, it worked to have separate champions, but when you do a massive show, WrestleMania, SummerSlam, Royal Rumble, and you have both world champions on the show, and it's like, well, who goes last? It became such a political disaster, but also perception mess, because it really tells you who has more cachet as champion. And 9 out of 10 times, it was the Raw title that got
Raw
that.
Guy.
Sometimes
the SmackDown champion was in the opener on those big pay-per-views.
Yeah.
And it's like, even though the opener is not the opener, to me, if your world champion is in the opener, I don't care what it is, he's not the world champion in anyone's mind.
So, and it looks like they're going back to 2 pay-per-views a month soon, and I'm assuming, the months of SummerSlam and WrestleMania, Rumble and Survivor Series, there won't be a second pay-per-view that month. But heading back to 2 belts, heading back to 2 pay-per-views, I think starting in September. How do you see this going down, Dave? They've tried this before with mixed success. They're kind of being forced to do it again with SmackDown going live on Tuesdays. What do you think is their best bet on finding a way to make this work?
You know, it's a different dynamic. Before, the issue was that the SmackDown, you know, your pay-per-view was an individual buy, and a lot of the SmackDown pay-per-views didn't do well. Now it's all about the network, and it's just giving people more content for their $10 a month. So it's not as much negative, although you don't have the same risk of having a bad show, because there is no bad show. Those million people plus are going to probably watch both shows anyway. I mean, the risk is so much product on a Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, twice a month. If it's once a month, it's one thing. Twice a month, you're asking like an incredible commitment from your fans.
Well, yeah, that's what I was going to ask, because that means every other week they're asking you to spend 3 or 4 hours on Sunday, 3 hours on Monday, 2 hours on Tuesday. Anybody that has a life, are they just going to say, fuck this, I can't handle it?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially like, okay, if it's one thing, if you are one of those people who has no life and you just love wrestling and can't get enough. And there's nothing wrong with that. I know people like that, and I'm half-assed that way anyway. But what if you're like a typical fan of, you know, and this is what they've been losing, and this is what you don't want to lose, is that guy who is a wrestling fan who wants to follow wrestling but doesn't want it to consume their life and still wants to follow their NBA team. They still want to follow their NFL team and everything like that. You go in there with 9 hours a week to keep up, they're going to say, you know, forget that. You know, my NFL and NBA team are taking priority over wrestling anyway, but I'll buy a pay-per-view, you know, a couple times a year, and I'll go to a live show when it comes to my town, because I'm a sports fan or I'm an entertainment fan. And that's the people that they've been losing, because to keep up you have to watch so much, and it becomes work. You know, when it was 90 minutes a week or even 2 hours a week and then once a month a pay-per-view, I mean, you know, you can have a life and you can have hobbies and you can watch other sports, and it's not infringing on it that much. But this, you know, it changes the whole dynamic.
What do you think, looking at the brand split, what do you do with the flip side of SummerSlam with Brock Lesnar? Because at this point, I would like to see something of consequence with him, be it he gets a new guy over, or what are the big money matches left that you can really do? I don't know what it is.
I mean, at some point, I mean, they've kept him so strong because the idea was to get a new guy over, which was supposed to be Roman Reigns, which they've never done. And now Roman Reigns, I don't know what their mentality is on Roman Reigns. It's hard to say, because the only guy I see that I have this weird feeling is like in their eyes, oh, we finally found our guy, is Cass. And they may be really wrong on him, because he's got a lot of weaknesses that have been hidden. But, you know, he's tall, and he's got blonde hair, and he's got long hair, and he's got a good body, and people react to him great because of Enzo, and to a degree because of him. So maybe that's the guy who Brock ends up losing to, but goddamn, that's probably... You don't want to do that for a couple of years.
I mean,
He's not ready. You do that now, and Cass will be exposed.
Yeah, in a perfect world, I think, you know, it's like back when Hulk came through in like the late 70s, and they send him away for a few years, get some seating, comes back as something totally different. I wish that could exist for Big Cass, where he could go away, come back as something else. Yeah, I know. And it serves a different purpose. And that's the other thing, looking at balancing all this, is NXT's revving up its touring. They're going to have now two brands touring on top of that and trying to prioritize all three of them. What master are they truly serving? And just to fall into the product as a casual fan and try to digest and keep up, it's going to be incredibly hard. They're going to have a very flooded product come end of 2016 going into 2017. I don't know how you do that and keep it simple and streamline all the stories you're telling, what you're trying to sell to the audience, and keep it hot and creatively stirring the pot and everything. It's a lot, because I look at Brock Lesnar and I just, who do you program him with that's box office bank, and also who can you build a star off of right away?
Who is box office bank, though? You have a whole bunch of guys. But I don't think there's any. I mean, I don't think Dean Ambrose or Seth Rollins are. Roman Reigns hasn't proven to be. I mean, John to a degree. So it's like
it's just the annual Band-Aids. It's Brock. It's Triple H. It's Undertaker, and Undertaker might be done. So, Dave, you and I have talked for years of what happens when they run out of Band-Aids. We're getting close to that, and there's nobody new ready.
Yeah. No, we're pretty much. I mean, I don't know, how many wrestling matches Dwayne Johnson's going to want to do left in his career. And he was, he's the biggest Band-Aid. He made those two giant WrestleManias. And he probably had something to do with this last one, although he wasn't a focal point, although he was advertised the whole time. But yeah, Undertaker, we're definitely winding down on him.
If we haven't already, and he's a very curious name, is what is his future, if any, in WWE? Because there's been so many mixed reports. He's supposed to do some touring. That got iced. There's a lot of debate about what happened there, what his relationship is right now with WWE. Do you hear anything? Does he have a positive relationship? Is it the same relationship, negative relationship right now with The Office?
I don't know what it is right now, but I know coming up to WrestleMania, even if it's bad, they'll make it good if they want him. But again, he... because there's many years where I've been told at this point, hey, you know what, he's done, he's not coming back. And then come January, it's like, well, he's going to come back for one more. So, he definitely was telling people after the last one that was it. But, come January, they and him both, it's money for him and it's a Band-Aid for them.
If you're him and you've been sitting home 9-10 months, you're feeling okay, they offer you, let's say, $1 million for one match, can you ever turn that down? So does it actually come down to it eventually being diminishing returns and WWE not being willing to offer that money, whatever year in the future that ends up being? If you're Taker, do you just keep taking it as long as it's being offered?
I think so. I see him like Sting and Hogan in that regard, because the Sting and Hogan crutches, they're gone now. So that's two others that are there. Sting's not going to wrestle again, and Hogan's not going to wrestle again. And Steve Austin, I don't think, he had surgery. She had shoulder surgery after throwing one punch. I don't see him wrestling again. And, he hasn't wrestled in more than a decade. So if he really wanted to wrestle, he'd have already done it. Come January, I absolutely think that they're going to be calling him, just because it's like, okay, so what do we do for a special attraction at Mania that we can advertise in a match? And it's almost like, he's the last one. And the only way I could see is if Shawn agreed to wrestle, that maybe they would go, well, Shawn's been gone for so long and he's great, and so maybe we don't need to call Mark. But
oh, yeah. I mean, if Shawn was wanting to do one last match, I think at this point that's way bigger than another Undertaker match. One thing that's interesting, though, Dave, because, there's actually a lot of stress being put on the payroll right now by adding many, many veterans who have yet to be named publicly. You've discussed some of these in the Observer newsletter. How do the economics of this all work now, especially when there's not pay-per-view money coming in?
Yeah, we have to see how many. I mean, I think that and I understand that the money being offered isn't too bad for these guys.
No.
So it's some significant money, and again, I don't know if it's how many guys are coming in. I believe that these guys are probably coming in to put over the young guys coming up. But yeah, just the fact you have two brands and to fill hours with exclusive content, exclusive guys, you got to add to that main roster. Where does that come in? The key, okay, our television numbers are fixed. You know what I mean? It's like there's a little bump every year, but it's essentially a fixed number. So you're adding a lot more. Where's the money going to come in? You've got to get network subscribers up. That's the only way this you know, ultimately this brand extension, the two key points to look at are, number one, the SmackDown rating, just because USA's, you know, really wants that number up and they're under contract and everything like that. And the other one is does the you know, the network number increase by enough money to cover these added costs, because USA is not throwing in more money and they are going live. So it is more costs. So, you know, that's the real, you know, that's the real key thing is you know, on that is, does the idea of now you're getting two pay-per-views a month for your $10 instead of one add a whole bunch of new people to the network? And, you know, we'll know that one pretty quick, because we know that the network, we know how the network works as far as, like, for most of the year it stays even, maybe even dips, and then it goes up in January through WrestleMania. So if this thing in not so much quarter three, but the quarter four number, when it comes out, if the quarter four number is essentially the same as the quarter two number, you know, and there's been no jump, that tells us that this brand split did not lead to new network buyers and won't. And then it's not a success. If we see a big jump, that tells us that some people feel, okay, now I'm getting two shows for my thing, and it's enough added. So, yeah, that's the number to look for, is at the end of quarter four, what the network number is.
And the problem that I see, you know, that a lot of times wrestling promoters overlook, in my opinion, let's say I'm used to paying $10 for two hamburgers, and you say you're going to give me four hamburgers for $10. Well, if I'm full after two, I can throw the other two away, and the two I ate, I didn't enjoy any less. But when it comes to following any sort of creative type of product, if I just consume half, I feel like I'm missing out. And so the half I want, I'm actually enjoying less. I think that's really the problem here.
Yeah, no, I agree, because I know people who don't watch SmackDown for that very reason, but they don't have to. Now you're telling them they have to. Look, I've seen so much in entertainment, and some in sports as well, where too much product has led to, and quite frankly, if you look at the last couple of years of wrestling, I think it's perfectly, it tells that same thing. Too much product wears people out, and you don't want it to be a chore and wear people out to be a fan of something. You want the fan thing to be a happy diversion that's just fun to watch and everything. And, you know, again, I believe that there's so many, you know, there's less wrestling fans than there's been in years and years right now. I mean, that's what the ratings seem to indicate, and the house shows seem to indicate the same thing. I know people will look at, like, things like YouTube numbers and say differently, but I don't know that that's not the regular core of people, just, you know, that are adding to those numbers. And I know the social media numbers are complete bullshit, because if the social media numbers meant anything,
right,
if they meant anything, we would see more people at the house shows. I mean, that's where we would see them for sure. Even if you go, well, ratings don't, you know, everything's changed, ratings are different, and you can make that argument. But what isn't different is live events are not different. Live events are exactly the same. And if they're going down, but you're getting a 570 zillion Facebook followers, then that Facebook follower number means absolutely nothing.
Well, I mean, they're definitely spending money, because whether it's paying for a whole crew to fly to China for a press conference, whether it's the Performance Center, which is no small budget venture, whether it's this Cruiserweight series bringing in all sorts of guys, there's talk of doing a similar type of thing, but for the women, maybe in September or October. So they're laying out money. I don't know where they're going to be recouping it from. And you know,
it's all network subscriptions. If all this stuff leads to new subscribers, then it worked. If it doesn't, you know, like I said, we'll have a great idea on this. Like I said, quarter four network numbers, the big thing to watch for. So
when in history previously did we have this few Americans watching wrestling every week? You would know way better than I.
I think, God, it's really hard, because the only period to me that was lower than this would be that, like, 92 to 95 period. But even then, you know, you still had a bunch of promotions that were on television. And if you added all those viewers of all those promotions up on television, plus you remember you had syndication, it wasn't just cable, I think the number of people watching wrestling would probably be well above what it is now. So I would say, yeah, I don't know that that's, you know, if you look back at the old days of syndication, you know, with where every city had their local promotion, I mean, that was way more viewers than now. Because, I mean, there were markets that did 7s and 10s and 20s, you know, I mean, like, you know, not 2s.
That mid-90s, though, was pretty bleak in terms of a sense of the industry and a sense of great contraction.
Because, oh, yeah?
I mean, you look at the live attendance for WWF back then, and you're doing Monday Night Raw. Yeah, I mean, you look at the attendance, Monday Night Raw, Bushkill, you know, casinos or whatever it was out there in Pennsylvania. And you go 3-4 rows back, and that's it. That's all there is. And who knows how many of those were comped as part of the casino. And I mean, they were doing very small houses on a regular basis. And I mean, you look at a SmackDown from this past week. I mean, yeah, they're blacking out the top of the arena, sure, but there are thousands in there, and I can't imagine it's even, you know, south of 40% paid attendance. Maybe it's even higher, but still, that's big. I don't know if we're really into that bleak mid-90s era.
Well, economically, we're worlds above. And, you know, economically, in some ways, it's stronger than ever because you've got that fixed television money. You know, I mean, that just completely changed the economics of wrestling. You know, when you get that, you know, if put it this way, if Paul Heyman or WCW had this kind of $100 million deal, you know what I mean? They'd be around forever, too.
And I think I think part of the reason they're doubling down on all this town and getting so aggressive, and the reason the true motive behind the brand split is to enrich the value of their Monday and Tuesday night programming. So come that witching hour in 2019 when they're up for renewal, they have some sort of not leverage, but some real great value they bring to the table, and that they've hopefully change the direction of the ratings. Can they accomplish that? I don't know. But I think they're putting all their chips down on the table for this one. They're putting them in the middle of the table for this one.
Here's the other one. By signing everyone who is in decent shape that they can and rating the other groups, it enables them to keep this monopoly, which enables them to keep the salaries artificially down. Because if there's a lot of free talent out there, that's good, somebody can come along, and I mean it's unlikely, but it's possible that somebody could come along, and if they had the right TV venue like a TBS and the right exposure and everything like that, this product you have right now, it's not an impenetrable product. It's not so popular. It's not so hot that somebody couldn't go in. Now TNA is a disaster. So they're not going to be that competition. You know, Ring of Honor is so, you know, they can't be with what they have now. They don't have the budget for it or anything like that. And I don't really see anyone that can be the competition for WWE. But if you got all kinds of talent out there, you know, and New Japan's problem is being from Japan. But, you know, if you had something, you know, even go back 3 years when New Japan was really strong and growing and they were at this hot thing. And you combined some of that indie talent that was in the United States with the New Japan, work a deal with New Japan, and get real TV in the United States, all of a sudden you've got a way better product than WWE, and you can market it as a way better product than WWE. It wouldn't necessarily beat WWE, but you'd be real competition for WWE. And again, as long as there's a lot of bodies and, you know, someone willing to take a risk, the door's opened. If they strip everybody and they got everybody under contract, then the door's shut.
Do you think Jimmy Yang will be one of the veterans that might come back? He was at TV. He met with officials yesterday. He's still only 35. He wasn't one of the initial names that we saw mentioned a couple weeks ago. But what do you think about Jimmy Yang?
Yeah, I think he fits exactly. But you know what this sounds like to me? Is remember when Bill Irwin and Tony Anthony and all those guys came in with those really bad gimmicks?
Yes.
Now, they're not going to bring these guys in with the bad gimmicks, I don't think. But it's the same thing in the sense that we want some veteran guys who we give a little bit of a name to put on television, to put over our guys. And I think that's what this group of guys is that role, you know, of you know, whether it's MVP or Tommy Dreamer or, you know, whoever, you know, guys that whoever they're calling or not calling, you know, that their role would be to get over the Casses and the American Alphas and the, you know, whoever whoever their guys are that need wins on television, because you really don't want to be bringing in American Alpha and stick them into the 50-50 booking thing. And you really don't want to bring in Finn Balor and stick him into the 50-50 club, because if you do, then you're just squandering their ability.
I hope they really don't rebrand the club, the 50-50 club, based on how their booking goes this summer.
But does WWE realize, is there any self-realization that the 50-50 thing has been so damaging?
Man, I don't know.
Because you can't fix the problem if you don't know it's a problem.
Yeah, I see a little less of it, but the thing is that all those guys that you see on Raw right now, you know, 80%, 70% are in that club already, and it's hard to get them out of it. So it's almost like, well, they're not over, so we don't need to protect them, and we've got our five guys that we're going to protect. So,
Protect Russell once a year.
Yeah. Well, I mean, here's the thing. Maybe they do realize it, and that's why they're calling these guys, because they know that, hey, you know what? If we bring in these guys and book them the way we brought in Baron Corbin, just as an example, and it didn't work, then these guys, why would it change with these guys? So let's figure out how can we get, you know, Tyler Breeze, or, you know, I know I've been sour on Tyler Breeze real quick, but, you know, like, how can we get somebody? I mean, like, you know, with Cass, obviously they're hooking him with Cena right now, which is pretty clever. But, you know, with a lot of these guys, it's like, how do we get these guys' moves over by beating people with the moves, as opposed to having to do screwy finishes in 50-50 matches? And that's what you want. You want good hands who can wrestle with them and not overshadow them, but be competent and not screw up their matches and cover for them when they make a mistake, and then lose to them in a nice way that gets their move over. You know, that's to me, that makes all the sense in the world.
How does a name like Breezango make it on air? Where's the quality control, Dave? How does that happen?
Usually it's an agent meeting, and they're
doing great again.
Usually in an agent meeting, they just start making jokes, and that's how it happens.
Yeah, that's your answer.
I
remember the first time they said Breezango, it was kind of like, okay, that's doomed.
Well, you know,
they still talk about it.
Look at one of the things that happens with the brand split, and when you draft these guys, a lot of the times they'll take a few guys that maybe aren't being utilized right, or try to do a refresh on them. And looking at this roster, there's certainly some guys that could use a refresh or a repackaging, or maybe splitting up a team. Yeah, a lot of them. You know, who would you look at in this roster? I mean, it's a who's who, a real pick 'em of guys that could be repurposed.
I'd have to look up and down because it's like what you got to look at is, okay, all these guys for the most part can use it, but who are the ones that really can benefit from it? Well, it's like Alberto, just an example. It's like there's a part of me that says that would almost answer him instantaneously, but then there's the other part of me in the back of my head going like, but he's been around for so many years. Or Cesaro is another one. They've been around for so many years that maybe people will just always think of them at that level. I don't know. I mean, it's worth a try. I mean, you want the Latino superstar for sure. And no way Jose is not that guy. Even though they think he is, Ziggler is like, just watching him last night.
Yeah.
I mean, he would have been a guy like 3 years ago where I would have said, you know, hey, let's try to turn some, but I mean, I think the ship sailed with him. I mean, I wouldn't, if like I'm in charge right now, unfortunately, I mean, I think, and I know people who are like big Ziggler fans, you could see on the internet, everyone, oh, that's, they should put Ziggler. It's like everyone's been beaten down by Ziggler so much that they actually now believe that he was never any good because Vince has decided it on, you know, anyway. So it's like, you know, I think he's just doomed. Instead of a 35-year-old guy, I'd like to see like a 28-year-old guy and start concentrating moving forward. So maybe the NXT guys are your guys. They haven't been tainted with this brush. The Finn, you know, even though Finn's 35 or 34, whatever he is. But the Finn Balor and Nakamura is also 35, 36, you know.
36, 37 but almost, yeah.
Are you able to explain, Dave, what is Cesaro's gimmick? Is he a businessman? Is he a stripper? Is he a lifeguard?
I think he's all three when he comes out. He goes through three. It's like, you know, if that career doesn't work out.
I thought he was James Bond, but...
But okay, so even if it's James Bond, is his gimmick that he thinks he's James Bond and he's delusional? Like, I don't see any element of this. For a guy that's so incredibly talented, can they not come up with something that would get him over, please?
I would love to see Kurt come back as his coach. I'd love to see Kurt come back as his coach and just be make him the European wrestling machine. And Kurt can still bump, can talk, but you're not putting him in that situation every night.
Yeah, I think, you know, the one with Cesaro where it was disappointing was because the fans got behind him naturally. And to me, it's like, you know, you don't really book that well when it comes to making stars for the most part. But every now and then, someone's going to get over, okay? And they can get over, and even if the booking isn't the best, they just get over. And to me, it's like if someone's going to hand you somebody who's got some momentum, man, I take that momentum until the momentum's not there anymore. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work, but I sure try.
Why do they seem instead to get upset that somebody got over that they didn't plan?
That's you know, that's the weird thing about today's wrestling. Before, like, wrestling people had always looked down on the fans historically and still do. But before, if the fans got behind someone, the only time you would screw it up on purpose is if you were the booker and it was a babyface who threatened your position. And then, yes, that did sometimes happen. But now, it's like, you know, with a Cesaro or something, it's like you don't really have that dynamic. There's not, you know, it's not like there's a booker who's a full-time number one babyface and he's threatening their number one babyface position, so I'm going to make sure he doesn't get over. You really don't have that dynamic, and you're looking to get guys over. So I don't understand that, like, yeah, as soon as a guy starts getting momentum, we beat him, you know, four straight weeks on television, and then he loses momentum, and then we go, see, we were smarter than the fans. sometimes I feel like when I watch it, it's like they are so convinced that they are smarter than their audience that they – the whole promotion is self-fulfilling prophecies.
Well, I brought this up on a show with Kevin Sullivan the other day where I feel like this is the first time in wrestling history where the fans are actually smarter than the company. I really believe
that. Well, it's not that they're smarter. It's that they've lost the ability to manipulate the fans. The art of pro wrestling, the core aspect of the DNA of professional wrestling is manipulation. It's manipulating the emotions, feeding them something they want before they even know they want it. And WWE, for some reason,
ahead of them.
Yeah, it's been reverse engineered, and in fact, now it's the audience that's leading the way, and they have a very hot, very hardcore, very small audience, but they are the ones that are coming out to every show, and they're manipulating the office into what they want to see. And so there's this weird half-pregnant thing where they kind of sort of push what the fans want, but they have no idea where the destination's going, so this thing ends up always going in a screwy direction, I think. And that's something they have to reverse, and Vince is the best manipulator, and it's not like I'm not knocking him, that is a compliment. He's a great manipulator, but somehow he's lost his course for it.
So here's the situation when that is all about what we talked about earlier today, when you lost your, a sports fan probably is a part of this group, but whatever the group is, the casual group that's only watching, you know, like an hour or so a week, if you can keep up in an hour a week, and it's not live and die, you're a lot more acceptable to what they're forcing you because it's not your life and you're not thinking about it too much. And Vince is trying to write for them, not realizing, you know, it's like, who's going to appeal to that casual audience? Roman Reigns is a good-looking guy, good athlete, blah, 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 blah. The problem is that because of all those hours of television, you've ran those people off, and what you're left with is those, you know, super hardcore fans, and they see wrestling in a different way, and they want to be in charge. Roman Reigns, it's you know, he was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and then it just got worse and worse because Vince didn't, you know, Vince did back down to an extent. He waited a year, another, not a year, but several more months to pull the trigger. But he still went with him as the main guy when the audience didn't want it, and then it became a big fight, and that's kind of where we're at right now.
Always give the fans what they want, but make sure you're a few steps ahead when you're going there. I remember how they knew Steve Austin was going to be the face of the company when he was just getting hot as a heel, and they had basically an 18-month strategy.
But here's the thing. The fans made Steve Austin before the company did. and they picked up on it. They didn't go. This is a real – that's one of the things that's depressing about this. Steve Austin started getting reactions, and he was not booked that strong at first. Yeah, he won King of the Ring, but that's not really that big of a deal.
Then he went through the rest of the summer. If you look back at those results, didn't seem to do much.
Yeah, so he's in there, and then he's just getting a bigger reaction than he should have every week. And then they decide, you know what we're going to do? We're going to put him against Bret Hart. And he lost the Bret Hart match. I'm talking about the Survivor Series match in New York, I think it was.
Yes.
But it was a phenomenal match, and Bret got him over. And got him over, you know, like he went even with Bret in Bret's first big match back. Bret barely won. And it was like, my God, this guy went even with Bret for whatever it was, 25, 30 minutes. And he was made, okay, now he's a top guy. And then I remember seeing him at the shows, and people were reacting to him like he was a main event guy, but they took to him first. But instead of, you know, WWE going with it and making him, you know, like legitimately that was like the real main event at that pay-per-view. Instead of like putting Cesaro in the real main event, and even if you got to beat him, you go in there with, and you don't really, you know, here's the other thing. Who's Bret Hart? You know what I mean?
Right.
Who's the Bret Hart? Who's the Ric Flair? You know, which is, that's where Ric Flair was so valuable in for all those years. Ric Flair would take one of these guys, and they would beat him to within an inch of their Ric Flair's life. And because Ric Flair had all that credibility, you know, Ric could cheat to beat him, or Ric could get DQ'd and all that. But it made guys. It made, you know, all those guys that came up opposite Ric Flair. I mean, not every one of them got over big, because some of them didn't have the charisma to get over big. But it was. But Ric tried to get all of them over, and some of them did, and some of them, you know, and that's how they made, you know, that's how they made a steady stream of new stars. And, because yeah. You had the guy who would go in there and make the guy. And I mean, you really don't have, like, even a guy like Seth, who's really great, he just doesn't have that thing where you can just, like, Dolph Ziggler wrestled Seth last night. Didn't make Dolph Ziggler. You know, when it was over, it wasn't like, oh my God, like, Dolph almost beat Seth. You know, like where you would watch, like, Ric Flair against a million guys and go, oh my God, they almost beat Ric Flair.
What are Seth's biggest wins? Like, what are the biggest names wins? On Seth's resume?
He beat Sting when they were...
No, and that's good, but I feel like it's the only one.
He beat Dean when they were, you know, when Dean was being fed to him. But I know what you're saying.
It's hard to now have those big wins stick out because there's so much programming, so many events, and it's going to multiply with now two pay-per-views on the network every month starting in September. And so it's just like there's such a sea of programming to find all those things and connect them and make a guy get over and heat up. It's so much harder, especially like you don't have the caliber of a Ric Flair who could stay over, was so despicable that you booed him. I mean, when he became a legend, it was hard. You know, when he got to that rarefied air in his 50s, yeah, it was hard to boo him, and you went along because it was part of the show, but he was such a deplorable heel that you hated him. He was very credible, and he had all the tricks, and he really was the total package. That's very hard right now. It's not there.
Yeah, well, you hit the nail on the head with so much programming, because I actually talked to somebody in UFC a couple of it was about a month ago, and we were talking about it was actually when Luke Rockhold beat Chris Weidman for the championship. So this is in December. This was a couple of months. And we were talking about, like, you know, why isn't Luke Rockhold a bigger star? And it was kind of like, well, you've got a show every week, so instead of people like for 4 weeks talking about, oh my God, did you see Luke Rockhold finish Weidman, who no one had ever beaten? Oh my God, you know, this is, and he's had to look and blah, blah, blah. Instead of people talking about for 5 weeks, by the next week, you've got a new show and you've forgotten about the last show. I mean, I think back, you know, one of the crowning nights of making a star, the picture perfect thing that we're talking about was Ric Flair and Sting at the first Clash of the Champions. Well, Clash of the Champions was something new. You never got to see main event matches like that on television. You know, and you really they were just getting into pay-per-view, but pay-per-view was only four times a year, so you could do that on a pay-per-view, and again, it would be significant because the pay-per-view would be something so special. And this Clash was almost like it was like a pay-per-view, but it was even, you know, it wasn't as big as a pay-per-view, but it was seen by everyone because everybody watched that damn show. So it was like you could make a star with one draw, and because it's like for weeks, it's like, did you see that Ric Flair Sting match? Oh my God, the Ric Flair Sting match. People would talk about it because you didn't have another match. You didn't go and rematch them the Monday after on Raw.
Right.
Or the, and then, you know what I'm saying? It stood on its own, and the next time you saw Ric Flair and Sting in a singles match, now granted you did it at some house shows, but the next time you saw Ric Flair and Sting in a television match that the masses saw, I mean, it was on, God, I mean, it, you know, and it would, I'd have to look things up, but it was a long time later. So that match, like, became something. And also, right afterwards, Dusty, you know, immediately saw what happened in that match, and all of a sudden, you know, the main events, you know, you'd start having, like, six-man tags with Dusty, Lex Luger, and Sting mm-hmm. as a team. I think it was Lex. But you would have, they would be the three top guys, as opposed to Sting being, well, okay, we did this, now let's put Sting right back in the middle where he was. If Dusty had put Sting right back in the middle where he was, we would never have had a Sting.
No, absolutely.
Because people would have gone, ah, he's just a middle guy who happened to have a great match with Ric Flair, like a lot of guys. But when Dusty immediately elevated him to that top tier, you know, that got, and Lex was the same way. They made Lex into a big star because, you know, Lex had those matches with Rick, but he kept at that top level and he was protected. So it wasn't like, oh, well, you know. And Lex was very effective. People forget about that because, you know, he ended up turning so many times and they right. watered him down. But Lex and Ric Flair drew a lot of money at one point.
And the thing that I think is, like you said, you don't have the time to digest and wait and anticipate the rematch. For me, it's like you had that 88 Clash match with Sting and Flair, but I didn't feel the true rematch didn't happen until Sting was chasing for the title in 90 after coming back from the knee injury, and that felt so big.
So it was from 80, what was it, 88 was the Clash, March 88,
yep.
right?
And July
and then
of 90.
The Bash is July 90. So yeah. It's 2+ years of a chase. Yeah, you had the Starrcade match, but it was part of a tournament, and mm-hmm. Sting won, but there was no title at stake.
Right.
And that was on pay-per-view. But yeah, for the most part, yeah, they did it a lot at house shows, but you didn't see it on TV. That's the problem with all the TV. Also, and with all the TV of, you know, you know, not, you know, you, again, you don't have guys running through. I mean, you know,
yeah.
And a lot of times people don't accept the guys running through because they're not, you know, it's you know, they're used to something different too.
And it's the
they
art
also
of the
weren't
finish.
Having food fights right before the big show.
But you know, you look at the art of the finish too. How many finishes do you really remember from Monday Night Raw 24 hours later? There was a time when that was a launching pad for feuds or to plant a seed for something down the road. Now finishes are really disposable. It's like fast food. It really does nothing for you. Well, it's quick and ugly, but it does nothing for you.
And they throw it at each other.
If you had that thing and you had 1 hour, you would remember it, because I remember NXT much better than I remember Raw. Because NXT I don't have to focus much on. I can watch my hour, and I mean that's the thing. It's not, you know, if I watch NXT and Lucha Underground, to me, really tell me something, because when those shows are over, number one, I want to see next week's show, and this is with someone who watches a ton of wrestling, and I feel like it's like I didn't get enough Raw or SmackDown. When it's over, it's like I feel I got too much. I mean, it's just like I when Monday's over, I cannot wait to watch WWE again. It's like, oh man, right. But Wednesday, after that 1 hour of NXT, and they plug a match for next week, it's like, I like the story. It's nice and simple. Easy to watch.
Yeah. Well, Dave, we know you got to get going because you actually got to finish up the Wrestling Observer, which we encourage everyone to check out. Go subscribe at f4wonline.com. It is the Wall Street Journal of this crazy business, and you learn a lot reading it. And it's just, to me, it's a must-read every week and has been since I started subscribing in around 92. So everyone, go to f4wonline.com. Check it out.
Years? Oh, my God.
I feel old. And you probably feel even older.
Yeah.
And everyone, also check out Jim Cornette Experience later this week. He'll be having on Dan the Beast Severn, UFC Hall of Famer, a man that he affiliated with back in the 90s in the WWF. Plus, the Ric Flair Show debuts tomorrow with special guest Cody Rhodes. And we'll be back on Thursday night with a special MLW Radio Extra featuring former pro wrestler and current UFC fighter Filthy Tom Lawler. Go VIP to listen to it by going to MLWRadio.com, click on the red button in the right top corner, and for just $1.99, you can have access on a monthly basis to all our VIP content, our archives, everything. With that said, everyone check out Dave on Twitter at Dave Meltzer, WON, MSL on Twitter at MSL, and I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Court Bauer. And until the next time, we are out.